The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Today, we are going to talk about the creative process. There can be no business process without creators. And I have two wonderful creators that I'm going to talk to today. Our focus today will be mainly in the theater. And my guests are playwright, author, poet, Diane Jenkins Harris. I had to get that Jenkins in there because that's your identification, right?
That's me.
And I have 11-time Adolco Award winner, sound designer, playwright, composer, radio producer, director, actor, percussionist, and by the way, he's a retired police officer. Now, how did he get that in there? David, welcome, David.
Thank you.
Now, my first, as I do all broadcasts, and I'm going to start with Diane. I want you to talk about where you were born, how you were born, and why you were born.
I was born, or why I was born, I guess they were having some great times. Third or fourth girl said I was born in the hospital at Florida A&M University. My parents were in college then. And we, in fact, my first home was Pocahontas Village, which is the Marriott housing at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, Florida. So my father had come back from the Korean War and under the GI Bill, went to college and got a degree in math and laying. They taught that in the black schools. They didn't teach that in the white schools. I grew up in the segregated South. And there was a program of bricklaying, agriculture, carpeting, tailoring, and hairstyle that at my high school that they didn't have at the other schools. So when my father finished college, he moved us to Gainesville. I was about two or three. He moved us to Gainesville to teach at the high school there. And I was actually raised in Gainesville. But my home is actually Tallahassee, and so are all of my relatives there. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and I think that most of my creativity came from her, except for my father, who was a storyteller. But my mother did all kinds of crocheting and embroidering, and she made us learn how to do all of this stuff during the summer. So we had work to do. We had creative work to do all the time, and I think that kind of influenced me as far as, because I still sew, I make jewelry. I'm not a good painter or writer, creator, but I write a lot. I write children's stories and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's where my creativity, I think, comes from.
Where did you go to high school at?
I went to high school in Gainesville. In fact, I went to an all-black school, the school that my father taught at, Lincoln High School in Gainesville, Florida. I went to an all-black school until I was in the 11th grade. And that's when integration came into Gainesville, Florida, 1969. Now, I know everybody thought integration was happening before then, but it wasn't. So they actually closed down the black school because they said that the white parents would not have their children come to the black school. So they closed our school down and bused us out of our neighborhood over to the what we used to call the white school, Gainesville High School. And that was half of my junior year. So they put us on split sessions. It was like 1,100, 1,200 students in my junior class. We graduated the next year, so I only had to deal with it for 1 year.
When you were going to the integrated school, when you
the white kids didn't want us over there. There were just a few blacks at Gainesville High School initially. And when we came over, it was too many for them. On top of that, they had a Confederate flag in the sidewalk made with marbles. The white students would walk around it, but we would walk across it. And there was a lot of fights because of that. We had to deal with a lot of the Southern prejudice because there were a lot of good old boys' children in the school. I remember when we had a black quarterback for the first time. They used to say that black people couldn't be the quarterback on the football team. They could lead the team. And boy, I'm telling you, they tried to burn us on the coach's lawn, and it was a big old white man who came out swinging a bat, beat him down. But it was a lot of turbulent incidents that happened because of the integration. Eventually, everybody settled down. We had no choice but to do what we had to do, which was go to school. But it wasn't easy.
Yours was not an unusual experience at that time. I went to high school at 71st High School in Fayetteville, North Carolina. In the school that I went to, there were about 10 or 15 of us, and there was about 1,500 white folks. And it was a turbulent time. It was a time of change that people did not want to happen, but it happened, and we persevered. And I think that those days people should still remember today, especially our kids, because many of our kids think that everything is great now, and that they just got to this position because of them. It is our ancestors who moved forward. We just picked up from what our ancestors did. David, where did you go to school at, David?
Oh, I went to school in the People's Republic of Brooklyn. You can go back to 1957, but I got bused to the white school in the third grade.
Wow. Wow.
What part of Brooklyn did you live at, and where did you go to school?
I was in Bed-Stuy. I went to school Prius 221 on Empire Boulevard and Schenectady.
Oh, I know that school. I also went to PS 133 in Harlem and PS 84.
It was like 30 of us on one bus, and I was in the third grade, and it was crazy. So what happened with me was that somewhere in the neighborhood of the third or fourth month being there, I had remembered these poems, and then I had to write a poem that my mother had to call the school board because the teacher accused me of plagiarizing the poem. She just thought it was just unusual for a black kid to write a poem like that. But unbeknownst to her, before my mother showed up, was that my sister was the editor of the newspaper at Franklin K. Lane years before. My sister was 15 years older than me, and she had always encouraged me to write poetry and short stories and to read and stuff. So my mother was just overwhelmed by that.
Where did you go to high school?
Oh, that's the exciting part. That's exciting, because high school, I'm 1968, I'm at Thomas Jefferson. I was supposed to be in Brooklyn Tech, but because I was in this program called Project Double Discovery, I ended up going to Jefferson. Before I went to Jefferson and Project Double Discovery, I'm on the campus of Columbia University at 14.
Oh, wow.
But this is 1966, Columbia University campus. The world was changing. I became a revolutionary. I found out I was really an African on that campus. Not a discovery then. Mm-hmm. My mother was a beautician, and I came back to Brooklyn talking about I didn't want to get my hair cut no more. I'm too black for my friends my age. I was just politically astute by that time. By the 8 weeks on that campus made me politically aware and astute about who I was. So now by 1968, I'm in my senior year at Jefferson. They had a teacher strike at September, October. Thomas Jefferson was one of the few schools that was open. The students had the school open. Then around Thanksgiving, they had the student strike, which I was part of. And that's when I got kicked out of Thomas Jefferson. I was out of school for 2 months. I went to Boys High, stayed there 3 weeks. I said, I got to get out of here. So then I ended up going to Harlem Prep. They wanted me to stay another year. I said, nope, I'm not doing that either. So I went to Brandeis to get my GED to go to Columbia.
In the 70s, I used to work for a company that's now out of existence called Household Finance. The one that I managed was over on Linden Boulevard in Van Sickling. So Thomas Jefferson, I used to go for principal for a day. And also the New York State had a program getting people to come in to speak. The school that I spoke at a lot was Thomas Jefferson. Those were the days. So now back to you, Diane. You left high school. And
yes.
Where did you go from there?
I went to college at the University of Florida. I was into science in high school. I went into University of Florida as a chemistry major. I actually turned down some chemistry scholarships to other colleges, one being Jackson State in Mississippi. My mother would not let me take it because that was the year that the students got killed at Kent State.
Yes.
And at Jackson State.
Sorry.
So they wouldn't let me go to Jackson State. And I went ahead and took the money. The University of Florida was giving out big bucks to Black students coming. My class was the second class that had more than 100 Black to be admitted to the University of Florida. There was hardly any Blacks there. They put us in one dorm. It was a fun time. But I went there, University of Florida, on a chemistry scholarship. And I graduated in 1975 with a degree in journalism and communications split education major.
So you were a nerd in high school, weren't you? When you left college, when you graduated from college, what was your first job?
My first job was department store manager for a Federated store, which is now Macy's. It was called Moss Brothers in Clearwater, Florida. I left Gainesville and moved to Tampa, St. Pete area. But I left there after I met this guy named Reggie Harris.
And you met him, huh? That's where you met him at.
I met him in St. Petersburg. And I met the lady who set me up on a blind date with him. Her parents and my parents went to college together. And she said, I know this guy. He just moved back home from Florida State. And he's not dating anybody. He's my boyfriend's next door neighbor. Why don't you come and hang out with us? I said, okay. After that, we were just inseparable. But
did your knees buckle when you met him?
They did. I kind of knew from the very beginning, the very first time I met him, I knew that he was not getting away from me.
Now, tell me something. You coming out of college, and you said you were the store manager. How did the people deal with you being young, just coming there, and being the boss?
Retail is different. Retail has always been, I think, infiltrated with more African Americans than a lot of the other industries. I remember working for Sears, Moss Brothers, JCPenney's when I was in high school, and I always had Black managers. So I'm not going to say that the opportunities were as good for me as they were for some of the blonde, blue-eyed chicks. In fact, I know that it wasn't, but I think it was okay. I enjoyed the work. The place where I was working, you're going to do 70 hours a week in retail anyway. I do my 70 hours and probably 20, 25 of them will be on the beach. So paperwork on the beach. I made it work to my advantage, but there was a lot of still discrimination from women and the Blacks, because even in an industry like retail, men still, they want to rule everything, even though it's more women working than men, but they want to lead. And it's a lot of discrimination that goes on. You've got to really work hard as a female, and especially as a Black female, to be general manager of the store. That's probably not going to happen.
Now, David, you're a revolutionary going to Columbia University. How did that work out?
I stayed there maybe 2 years, but what happened was my mother was a domestic for Morris Levy, who was owned Roulette Records. Morris gave me a summer job at Roulette Records to do promotion and sales for the primary and secondary markets in R&B. And so I had some records to promote. Well, I discovered that I liked $350 a week after taxes and American Express card, that I wasn't going back to school. The money was right here. So Morris let me and his lawyer's son, Wally Brill, will only be here for the summer. We ended up staying like 2 years in sales. Finally, my mother got me fired after Joe Galloway from Columbus Circle. Well, Marley and I both got fired, but she said she didn't want me to be no gangster. Joe Galloway got killed at Columbus Circle.
I remember that day.
And we got fired that same week. By Friday, we were fired. Marlis called me and Wally in the office and said, you know what, guys? I love you both. Your parents don't want you here. So this is your last day.
I remember going to Roulette to talk to Morris because I had some artists that I was, quote, managing.
Morris, since I was 10 years old, he bought me my first drums. No, he actually put the money for me for Columbia. So I was grateful. I had to go to the police department and he had to make a reference. He got pissed when he found out. Because I spent all that money on that and that man, and he decided to go to the police department. I am Gerald. He'd have drunk with me for years.
For my audience, Morris Levy was the president of Roulette Records and had a dubious past. He had a very dubious past. And a lot of artists were really cheated out of royalties.
Yeah, he was notorious.
Yes. So now you left there, and where did you go?
When I left there, I went to Atlanta, but Warner Brothers, and I went to L.A. to make records. And LA was just too slow. They want to go to the beach every day. I'm a New York kid. I'm used to working fast. LA came back to New York to work at Dan Don Studios. Doris Elliott hired me as a secretary. I couldn't type, really. She let me type for 3 days. Then she put me in the studio. She said, what else do you know how to do? I said, I know how to do work down in there. Because Mars had sent me to school audio engineering school at the new school at that time. So I learned how to handle the board and make records. I knew how to do that.
All right. We're going to get a little bit more into that. Now, Diane, you're in retail. Did you have other jobs?
Yeah. My best job, I think I used to be a territory sales rep for Dr. Scholl. And I had, my territory was every beach from Savannah, Georgia. I would do 10 calls in the morning, and I would be on the beach by 2 every afternoon. Because I went to college in Florida, every town up and down the coast, I knew somebody. Mm-hmm. So I'd call them up and we'd end up on the beach or either dinner that night. I was just having a party every single day. I loved that job. They gave me a car. They paid me $350 a week. They gave me what they call a travel letter, and everything was paid for. It was just wonderful.
But you didn't have an American Express card like David, huh?
Well, the travel letter, it was like the American Express card. Then actually, Xerox stole me from Dr. Scholl, and I started selling Xerox copiers. Then Reg and I got married and moved to Connecticut, where I transferred to Hartford, teaching off of Xerox at the time, training customers on the large duplicators. I was a corporate girl. I did that until I had my daughter, and that was in 1980. By that time, Reggie had gotten a job in New York at WNBC. We moved to Hackensack, New Jersey, and I became a housewife. That was my transition from corporate to creative.
This creative was a fact of necessity of doing something after you were out of the corporate world?
Actually, I was fine just having the babies and staying at home. I didn't know I was a playwright. I've been writing since I was 12 years old. I have a journal that I've kept since I was 12 years, but that was just from my head. But when I, one day, and this is the story of how I became a playwright, okay? I had written this play about my mother's first marriage, which I was just fascinated with. I found out about it because my mother's oldest sister wanted to get even with her for some reason, and she led me to see a picture of my mom and her first husband and a baby. So I wrote this after I confronted my mother. She told me, well, he was a baker by day and a bandit by night. He was a cat burglar.
Illustrious lives are in the arts.
I was fascinated. And I said, you know, what happened? All of the stuff that was in her house, all of the gifts that he had given her, had been stolen. And one night the cops came and confiscated everything, even the wedding rings from her finger. She was 19 and he was 39. She didn't get taken to jail because she just obviously didn't know what she was getting into. But so when people tell me these stories, for me, characters start talking to me. And once they start talking, I give them a life. And I wrote this play and I put it in a drawer. Reggie had started working for WNBC. And he was doing this story on this brother whose name was Jamal Joseph, who had just gotten released from prison, 10 years of prison in Leavenworth. Jamal was a Black Panther. I know you know him, David. But
he was one of the ones I was considering having on the broadcast today.
Oh, my goodness. I am one of his mentees. Charles was involved in a play that Jamal wrote while he was in prison. And Reggie was doing the interview at Tavern on the Green, and he told me about it. The thing is with Reggie, he didn't mind me always being with him. He would call me up. He said, I'm doing this story over here. Charles Dutton is here. Why don't you come on over here and meet everybody? I come and I just hang around with the news crew. So I met Charles Dutton. I met Jamal. I didn't know this, but Reggie had given Jamal my play. And so Jamal's like, yeah, I read your play. And why don't you come to Touro College? I said, you read my play? And he said, yeah. I didn't know Reggie had taken it out of the drawer and took it to Jamal. And I was a little upset because I had never let anybody read my stuff. But Jamal invited me to Touro College, to his Black theater workshop. And I went to Touro College for about a year with Jamal and started developing my shows. And that's how I got started. I went from there with Jamal to the Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center. Then he did something for Negro Ensemble Company. So I just kept following Jamal, just continuing to develop. And he's been my mentor ever since.
Now, David, your next steps from where you were, leaving the gangster, Morris leaving
my wife. I saw her on television in Texas and I followed her. I met her, I told her I was going to marry her and give her a baby. And she looked at me like I lost my mind. and I ended up marrying her, but we didn't have no kids. So I stayed married for about 8 months. I came back to New York from L.A. I hooked up with Dan Don Studios, but I also had taken all these tests, police department, correction. I ended up going to correction first. And I stayed in correction 6 months, and then PD picked me up. So I left correction while I was in the police academy. 2 weeks before I graduated, I married my second wife. That was that, and I stopped doing anything creative until the layoffs came. You know, so all that time, I'd been a musician. I played with Eddie who? Palmieri. Eddie Palmieri. Okay.
And you got to tell people, because you have an illustrious background.
I played with the Coasters, and that's before I put a layoff. When the layoffs came is when I hooked up with, that was Rose Tour Records back then, with Mark Radiz, Brass Construction, Ohio Players, and the Tramps. That's when that happened. I was on tour with them for 8 months, back and forth. I bought up my first house in Brooklyn.
So is that how you got into sound, David?
No, how I ended up doing sound was because of Tunde, they sound good.
Oh, okay. Well, now David has done the sound on mostly all of my projects.
I came to MBT through Mamie Stone, who knew me from Columbia. Her son were very good friends. And Mamie was at MBT. And Mamie invited me to come to produce Tunde and Nobby and to produce their record. But I couldn't imagine doing a record with them. So I stayed at MBT and I said, oh, maybe I want to make a movie. I want to know how to direct. So I got to know what actors do. And they had this TTS course. I took that course and I never left MBT from then. So the first thing that I got to do work on sound design was actually the late, oh my God, you know her. You knew her too. From New Jersey. She's from New Jersey. Playwright. Zinger's Children. Fiona Thomas. Yeah. Her workshop, her writing workshop. And we produced a book and a show out of that. The movie. First play I've ever sound designed was Heaven Sent. From then on, I went to, I didn't leave MBT until later. And I ended up at New York Rican Post Cafe. So my first sound design, my first award, Delgo was the musical director of The Legacy, which was Gordon Nelson's piece, the gospel show that ran for 10 years. Then I did, when I started sound design for real, was at New York Rican. And the first play that I won for was actually Amiri Baraka's play. Yes, it was Amiri Baraka's play. Yeah, it was a 45-minute play, and I had 65 sound cues on cassette. So that was an amazing piece. It was just crazy. That was my first design award.
Tell me, how did it feel the first time that you won an award? That's about the 11th time. It was just like, talk to me about the first time.
True, I wasn't even there for. So the first time, I was overwhelmed. I really was. I can hardly talk. I remember sitting in the audience, not expecting to be called, being called, and not hearing my name. Like, David, get up. So it was like that.
I remember 2019 when you won the award. And it was like you walking on the stage. Yeah, I'm here. I'm back again.
But I appreciate that because there was no other body that represents that we get to represent it outside of Adelco. It looked like I'm being nonchalant, but I'm really not. I'm always glad to win. I'm always grateful to be acknowledged. No, there isn't.
Yeah. I know the first time that I got nominated, I knew that I wasn't going to win because my teacher, Lawrence Holder, was also nominated. I said, well, oh, my goodness, I know I can't win over Lawrence. He's my teacher.
It came from Diane's first play that I worked on. Wow.
Diane who?
Diane Harris.
Oh, okay.
The first play I worked on, Diane, I really remember a lot because it was such a hot mess, was Bo Gator.
Woo! I know.
Well, right. Tell us about the production. We were talking about the creative process. First, before you get on that, I want to go back to Diane. And on that particular play, how did it come about to you? Were you walking down the street one day and you said,
I'm a daddy's girl. And my daddy was Bo Gator. I was telling you he was a high school teacher. And they used to call his classroom the Swamp. Because he had the bricklaying classroom, and across from him was the agricultural classroom. So down there, the windows would all be steamed up because of the plants being watered next door. So they started calling it the Swamp, and Daddy said, you know what? Guess who was the boss in the Swamp? I'm the Bo Gator in the Swamp. I'm the baddest. I'm the best looking, but I'm still the meanest. So all of you got to come through me. And that was always interesting to me, but because my father would start the year off with it's all men in the class, and he would say, I have four daughters, and if I see any of you at my house, I'm going to kill you. So that was the Bo Gator. And so we had a hard time getting dates, in other words. But so I was interested in my father's background. He had some white people in his life who some of them were black that passed for white. And it became interesting to me to find out who they were, what was going on. And in doing that, I wrote Bo Gator, the play. So it starts off as two men in a boat fishing. And Bo Gator is having this internal problem with his father, who left the family to pursue another life as a white man so that he could make money to send home to his family. But it involved taking him away out of the family. So he was not there, but the money was there. And Bo Gator was a little bit messed up behind it because he couldn't pass for white. That's pretty much the story.
Okay, now you got this story. I understand the first one, so your husband took it to Jamal without your knowledge. How did you proceed from the point of your creativeness to actually having it on the stage?
You mean from the first one? That one never got produced. Bo Gator, I took it to Tunde Samuel. Tunde was how you might have a soulmate in the business. Tunde really got me. He got my creative spirit. I remember I took him a copy of Bo Gator, and he said, wow, he said, when I was reading this play, I heard Bobby Womack. And it was so weird because I was listening to Bobby Womack the whole time I was writing the play. And I said, oh my goodness. So he said, we're going to produce this, and the rest of it is. It wasn't the first time. David, I don't know if you remember Leon Pinkney and John Terrell. We did it over in a mausoleum in Brooklyn on a little rubber boat. So we had done it a couple times before Tunde really put it up as professional as it right. turned out, because the MBT production was just, I never have asked for a better production than that. It has seen a couple of productions before that, which we were built up to.
Tell everybody what MBT is. So now.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the National Black Theater in Harlem. And that's Tunde Samuels was the artistic director. Right. Oh my God, I just forget the name. Right.
Bob Rand.
Oh my God.
I knew that's what you were leading to.
Tier, of course, she is the one who founded the National Black Theater in Harlem. And I think her daughter is running it now. Yeah, but yeah, they're still there, and they bring really some great theater to the community.
We're back to David. You can continue.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 1987, and I had been a graduate of Tier Technologies, and I was in the Entrepreneurial Artist Program at NBT, and I was a police already, working in narcotics. And actually, at that point, I had done a lot of undercover work and worked at the District Attorney's Office in Kings County. I was a liaison between the police department and the District Attorney's Office. At this point, I said, you need to write me a play about being the police. So I said, okay, I'll work on it. And finally, I did. In 1988, he did a reading of my play. It was called White, William Henry Ida Thomas Edward. And I wrote that play, and I did it as a radio drama. I never mounted it. But 1991, I became a priest, a Yoruba priest, a Baba Lorisha. After 5 years of being a priest, marrying a third wife, I began writing my first play, actually, in 1998, my first Orisha play. So I write this play about I'm a priest to Oshun, and I do a reading with Frank Zabera Writers Workshop. I'm at a party with Garland Lee Thompson, Sr., in Midtown Manhattan, and he says to me, you got to play because I got a spot next week. I don't have any playwrights. I said, Garland, I just wrote this play, but I got to bring my boy in, Anthony, because Anthony's going to direct it in 93. After being at the National Black Theater Festival, I got a radio show on BAI. I did some of Diane's plays on the run.
Did you say, before you go on, did you say that you were from an island of Brooklyn or an island of Jamaica?
The People's Republic of Brooklyn, Caribbean island in the world.
I'm thinking of In Living Color. I said that last week, but I'm thinking of In Living Color because you have had so many jobs and so much.
That was my first Orisha play. And Tunde wanted to do it, but he couldn't right then. So Rome did it. Rome and Miguel right. Descape. It was a hit.
Who is Rome? I want people to know who these people are you're talking about.
Rome Neal. that I've been working around, sounded on a number of projects. I got a number of Delcos from that, from New Eureka. They have Julius Caesar, a few of them, and I'm grateful. Then it went on to go to the National Black Theater Festival in North Carolina with Oshun, The Goddess of Love with Garland. And they sold out every night. The next play I wrote actually was Oya. That was done at National Black Theater initially. Then I did some more with Garland, and then I took it to Riverside. That was my first off-Broadway production, was Obatala. I had Arthur French in there. I wrote that play for Arthur French because I got tired of seeing him as the lecherous old man. I wanted him to have his own woman, his own wife, without any conversation about some lecherous old man. So that was, I wrote that for him.
Now, Diane, when you also did a play that ended up in Winston-Salem.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Why Old Ladies Cry at Weddings.
Yep.
That was actually, it started out with Jamal Joseph. It took me 8 years to finish that play. I started out at Truro College, and it was called The Same Difference. And I brought it to Frank Sevier Writers Workshop and completed it, the workshop. I guess I workshopped it maybe for a year, maybe a year and a half up there. Everybody knows during that time, Frank Sevier Writers Workshop was located at 125th Street and St. Nick, and it was in a third floor loft. And in the winter, Garland didn't have any heat up there. So we climb up those stairs up there writing. And then in the summer, he didn't have any fans or any air conditioner. So we climb up there and we sweat all night long.
You persevered.
We persevered. And it was the right place to be at that time because we had a lot of good stuff that came out of there. So Why All Ladies Cry at Weddings was The Same Difference. And I remember Garland said to me one day, he says, now we need to think about a new title for this. And it was The Same Difference isn't going to do it. He said, now I want you to think about a new title. And I don't know, it just came to me because it was about marriage and infidelity. And just out of the blue in my head, it said, that's why old ladies cry at weddings. There's infidelity and lies and the things in marriages that just pop up. And everybody asked me why it was named that. The spirit gave it to me. I don't know why it was named that. It was just, that just came to me. But sometimes that's the creative process. You don't know why it happens. Sometimes I would be sitting up at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 to 4 was my favorite writing time. And it's very quiet and everything is still. And that's when a lot of the good stuff comes to you. And I would get up the next morning and read what I had written. And I said, wow, I didn't even know that I thought like that. But sometimes you just can't control the creative process. Sometimes it just comes out of you. That's what creative spirit does. And I had to get used to that. But so anyway, I wrote the play and Garland mounted it at the Frank Sevier. I don't know. I think we did about 10 or 12 performances of sold out performances here in New York. Then we took it down to National Black Theater Festival and in Winston-Salem. And it was so funny because the audience was standing up talking back to the stage, how Black people do in the movie. It was a packed house that night. And I was sitting on the steps with Angela Bassett and Bill Cobb. And there were no more seats left, but they came in with me and sat on the steps. It was just that crowd. Now, Angela is from St. Petersburg, Florida. So I kind of knew a lot of people that she knows. And I knew she was down. So it was still. But when I tell people that I wrote that play as a drama, I had to stop telling people that because it was so funny that I had to stop telling. I had to tell people, yeah, I really meant for that to happen. But no, I didn't. I wrote it as a drama and it was so funny. People just would just fall out laughing. And I had to just retire that and say, okay, I write funny dramas.
Both of you, have any of you all had any plays that ended up on Broadway?
Not yet.
What prevents, say, plays like yours that are funny and that shown that it has an audience, what prevents it from being on Broadway?
Money, absolutely money.
Yeah,
but there's so much money out here doing plays. Is there a reason why you cannot get the monies to do some of the stuff that you all have done? because you all show that you all have the creativity and it's universal. Plays are universal. It might have a...
It's funny. We say, because I did off-Broadway, and what gets in the way with the money is the union, because they have to get paid. They'll do the health and welfare, their pension, all that first, and then their salary. And it's not that you don't want to do that, but the money's just not available. We don't invest in ourselves. You got to be familiar with the venue, what the venue is going to be, how long is it going to run, and how many people in the show. My shows, because I have a big cast, they're difficult to do on Broadway. I have a very large cast. It's like doing Lion King on Broadway.
How many cast members do you have?
Got about 18 cast members, plus at least 4 or 5 musicians.
Diane, why haven't yours been on?
I was supposed to do a 10-city tour of Old Ladies, but I had signed a contract that gave the rights to my show to the producer for 5 years. Now, unless they agree to ease on the contract, they can say yes or no, whether you have raised the money or not. So I got caught up. I'm not trying to be bitter about it because it didn't stop me from doing what I do, but it did limit me. But you have to understand going into the situation as a creator that you better have some good lawyer up, and you better read every contract that you sign and make sure that it gives you an out to at least have control over your work. That's another one of the things that kind of stops you from continuing to pursue funding.
See, I was fortunate because I came through the Morris Levy School of Economics, way on top of that point.
But I started producing my own stuff.
How much does a typical one of your plays cost to produce?
Which one are you talking to?
Both.
My plays don't cost under $70,000.
Maybe
only 2 union people.
It would cost $40,000 to $50,000 at least, yeah. I did do a run out in Staten Island, 2 shows, and it cost me $10,000. But that was real tight budget, and it was more than bearable. My daughter was the stage manager, and my son was moving around the set. They were like 10 years old.
Did they wave at the crowd when they did it? We talk about our freedom, and we talk about how the theater was one of the outlets of getting the idea of our freedom. You can think back to the different plays that talked about the plight of Black America, but so much of the time we don't support our own efforts. The terrible thing is that, yes, you want anybody to put monies into something that you're doing because it's good. It has no color bearings, it's just good. But sometimes our folks don't look at that. And I understand sometimes it's because they have had less money. But what you want people to do is just participate in it, even if it's $5 or $10, especially in this day of internet. $5 and $10 adds up to a whole lot of money when a lot of people just contribute that to it. And part of my reason for doing this show is, yeah, I have some interest in that also, but it's just the idea that we have wonderful ideas and wonderful things, and we don't have the monies all ourselves to do it. I always remember a something that Percy Sutton told me one time. Percy Sutton was buying BLS. He said he went to some of his white friends who had the money, said, "Did you go to this person first? Did you go to Michael Jackson? Did you go to these folks first before you came to me?" People need to understand that they need to help. We need to be able to reach out to our community. You're not going to get everything from them, but it's the seed money is most important. That's what you want to do.
It is. I remember we were so proud to become seed money for a restaurant in Harlem a couple of years ago. In fact, Ms. Percy Sutton was one of the investors also. Amy Roots on 116th. Unfortunately, it did not survive. But during the time that he was opening it up, we were feeling this, that here we can give something back to the Black community. And there's a group of investors that did this. And we were all feeling really good about it. It was some good food coming out of it. And it was a good meeting spot. And it was something that we could pour our support into, that I think it made us all feel good. And I used to think that National Black Theater was like that also. And I wish that we had the institutions in the theater that we could do something like that.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't exist right now, though.
We have to make it exist. Now, let's go on to future. What are your future projects?
Right now, I am publishing children's stories. And actually, I'm writing, trying to write Wild Ladies Weddings as a screenplay also. And I'm also writing a new piece, my first short film, These Uncertain Times. I'm starting that. I've got several projects, but that's always the way it is. I've always got a lot of projects, and hopefully I can finish them up. But because my mind goes so fast, but I've been trying to publish a book that Reggie started. I've got 5 children's stories that I'm publishing individually, and I'm writing more plays.
I love that. I love it. You got great stories. I'm working on a short animated film that I'm doing myself on based on one of my plays called Creatures, Tales from the Bush, and it's about the animals, vegetables, and minerals of the Yoruba discourse.
Oh, yeah.
An animated film that I'm working on that, actually shooting it myself. And I got music for days. I'm working with a friend of mine, Tommy Mandel, on his opera. He's got that we've been working on for like at least 40 years now, almost, that I've known him. I've done films, major films with him as a composer, and we've been friends forever. I'm working on some new stuff for me musically and the writing stuff, composing and writing, and that's what I do. I'm waiting for my grandchildren to keep coming.
Yes, I get that joy every day too.
Amazing to sit back and think. I have some friends that have great grandchildren. Where did the time go? How did those people get so old and left me behind?
I'll be 70 in July.
July what?
July 22nd.
Okay, because Stephen is July the
12th.
And I'm July the 13th.
That's where all the creative people were born, huh? In July. I thank you all so much for being on this broadcast. This was a fun broadcast. I don't usually do this, but I want to announce this on this show that I'm going to have a special show that is an anniversary show for such a sad occasion, George Floyd's death, is going to be at the end of May. I'm going to have George Floyd's uncle on and Chris Owens, a friend of mine who we've worked together on many projects together. And I thank David so much for agreeing to be on. The reason why I didn't talk so much about the police department, because I wanted to get into that, but I didn't want to do it on this show. That's a better forum for doing it. And forward to doing it. So I want to thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Tune in next week for another wonderful show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Hello, my name is Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is an author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!